And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Pitcher. Today, I'll be reading from the Story Bag, a collection of Korean folk tales by Kim Soo-in. The Tiger of the Kundong Mountain. There once lived a very famous marksman and hunter. He was such a fine marksman that he could shoot down any bird in flight almost without taking aim. Deer and wild boar were no match for this hunter once they entered the sights of his gun. He was never known to have missed anything. In those days, the Kundong Mountains were full of tigers. Often the beasts would come down from the fastnesses and steal not only horses and cattle, but even human beings. But there was not a single man who could conquer the tigers. Many hunters had said, "I'll get those tigers," and had set out. That none had ever returned. Instead, they had become the prey of the tigers of the Kundong Mountains. One day, the famous marksman said, "Now it's my turn. I shall kill every tiger in the mountains." The hunter, so saying, set out, refusing to listen to those who tried to hold him back. The tired hunter went on and on. At the foot of the mountains, he came to a lonely inn. The proprietress of the inn saw the hunter and said, "Alas, are you also going to the tigers to have them eat you up? Listen to what I say. It is for your good that I tell you. If you value your life, give up your foolish idea." However, the hunter refused to listen. "In his heart," he said proudly, "but with my skill, there isn't a tiger anywhere that can beat me." Out loud, the hunter said to the woman, "Old woman, just wait and see. I shall come back in a little while, carrying a tiger as big as a mountain on my back." And laughing to himself, the hunter continued up into the mountains. That was the last that was seen of him. 5 years passed. 10 years went by, but the hunter did not return. When the hunter left home, he left behind a male child who had just been born. Now he had grown into a young lad, skilled with a gun. In fact, he had become almost as good a marksman as his father. The young man knew well the reason why he was fatherless. He had long ago decided in his heart that he himself would shoot down the tiger that had eaten his father. When he reached his 15th birthday, the boy went to his mother and said, "I would like to set out for the Kundong Mountains. Mother, please let me go." But the mother did not want to lose her son. With tears in her eyes, she tried to stop him. "Even a famous marksman like your father was eaten by the tigers. How can you avenge your father's death? If you go, you will never return. That is as clear as daylight. Oh, quit thinking about such things and stay forever by your mother's side." "Go, mother. I shall surely find the tiger who ate my father. I shall shoot it down and avenge his death." And the son earnestly begged his mother to let him go. And finally the mother said, "If you want to go so much, do as you wish, but first, let me ask you one thing. Your father used to have me stand with a water jug on my head. Then he would aim at the handle of the water jug from a distance of 1 league and shoot off only the handle without spilling any water. Can you do the same thing?" And all this, the young man immediately tried to match his father's feet. He had his mother stand 1 whole league away with a water jug on her head. He took careful aim, but he missed the mark entirely. So he gave up his idea of going to the mountains and practiced 3 more years with his gun. After 3 years, he tried again. This time he succeeded in knocking off the handle of the water jug on his mother's head without spilling a drop of water. Then the mother said, "Son, your father was able to shoot the eye out of a needle from a distance of 1 league. Can you do this?" The son asked his mother to stand with a needle in her outstretched hand. Then he walked back a distance of 1 league and, taking careful aim, let go a shot. But he failed to shoot the eye out of the needle. Once again, he gave up his idea of going to the Kundong Mountains and settled down to another 3 years of practicing. At the end of 3 years, he again tried the same trick. This time, with a crack of his gun, the eye of the needle fell to the ground. Of course, what the mother had told us not in the fall of life. The mother had thought that if she told him such stories about his father, he would give up his idea of going to avenge his father. But her son had now successfully performed each of the feats she ascribed to her husband. Even the mother could not help being moved by her son's single-minded desire to avenge his father's death, and she finally gave him permission to leave for the Kingdong Mountains. The son was overjoyed. He immediately set out for the mountains. At the foothills, he came across the same small inn where his father had stopped years ago. The same old woman was still with him. The old woman asked the young man what he intended to do. He told her how his father had been eaten by the tiger and how he had practiced for years to avenge his death. The old woman answered, "Yes, I knew your father. He was the greatest marksman in all the land. Can you see that tall tree over in the distance? Why, your father used to turn his back to that tree and then shoot down the highest leaf and the highest branch from over his shoulder. If you can't do the same thing, how can you expect to avenge his death?" The hunter's son, when he heard this, said he also would try. He placed his gun over his shoulder and took aim and shot and missed. He knew then that this wouldn't do, and he asked the old woman to let him stay with her for a while. And that day he kept practicing shooting over his shoulder at the tree. Finally, after 3 years had passed, he was able to shoot down the highest leaf and the highest branch. Again, the old woman told the hunter's son, "Just because you can do that, it still does not mean you can outshoot your father. Well, your father used to set an ant on the side of a cliff, and then, from a distance of 1 league, shoot that ant off without even stretching the surface of the cliff. No matter what a fine marksman you may be, you can't match that." The young man went. Tried to do what the old woman said his father had done. Again, he failed at first and had to practice 3 more years before succeeding. Of course, all that the old woman had told him had been made up because she wanted to save the man. But the hunter's son, not questioning her once, had practiced till he could do whatever she said his father had done. The old woman was filled with amazement and admiration. "With faith, man, with your skill, you will avenge your father's death." So saying, the old woman made many balls of cooked rice for him to eat along the way. The hunter's son thanked her sincerely and started out along the path leading into the heart of the Kingdong Mountains. Eating as he went the rice balls made for him by the old woman, the young man pressed deeper and deeper into the mountains. For days and days he wandered through the wilderness. After all, the Kingdong Mountains have 12,000 peaks and stretch over a vast area, and he had no means of knowing where the tiger lay hidden. In his heart, he kept praying he would be able to find the tiger that had eaten his father, and he continued wandering without any exact destination through the vast mountain range. One day, while the hunter's son was seated on a big rock taking a rest, a lone priest came up to him and asked me, "Excuse me, sir, if you have a flint and stone, may I borrow it?" The hunter's son brought out his flint and stone from a leather purse hanging from his belt and handed it to the priest. The priest struck fire with the flint and stone and lighted his tobacco pipe. As he opened his mouth to take the first puff, the young man caught a glimpse inside the priest's mouth. There he saw a sharp fang. "My husband was just killed by a bad man. The soldier came to me and said, I must hurry and dig up some potatoes and take them to him to eat. Once he eats these potatoes, he will become alive again. That's why I have to hurry. The young man thought, and looked carefully at the hands of the woman digging potatoes. He saw not human hands, but the hairy paws of a tiger. The hunter's son immediately lifted his gun and took aim. Bang went the gun, and the old woman in the potato patch toppled over and turned into an old sea tiger. The hunter's son continued on his way. In a short while, he came upon a young girl carrying a water jug balanced on her head. The young man was thirsty and asked, oh, please kindly give me a drink of water. The young girl answered, I'm sorry, but I can't stop. I'm in a terrible hurry. The souls of my father-in-law and mother-in-law came to me and said they had been killed by an evil person and asked me to bring them water. I must hurry with this water and give it to them so they can come alive again. So saying, the girl started hurrying on. From the front, she was really a young girl, but from behind, she was tiger with a long tail. The hunter's son raised his gun and let fly a shot. Down came not a girl, but a young sea tiger. The hunter's son continued on. Down the road he saw a young man walking hurriedly toward him. The hunter's son called, sir, won't you sit down with me? Let's exchange talk of our travel. No, I can't waste any time. My parents and my wife just came to me in a dream and told me that they'd been shot down by a bad man. They asked me to come and offer sacrifices for them. If I delay longer, it'll be too late for them to come alive. This young man, too, had a long tail hanging behind it. The hunter's son immediately raised his gun and shot the man dead. By the time the man's body hit the ground, it had changed into a splendid young tiger. The hunter's son was pleased with himself for having got rid of four tigers in such a short time. He felt greatly encouraged and continued on his journey, wondering what next lay in store for him. After a short while, he saw a huge, bright animal as big as a mountain squatting in the distance. It was a huge, huge grandfather tiger that must have been alive for 1,000 years. The white-haired grandfather tiger opened its great mouth to swallow the hunter. The young man quickly took aim and shot a bullet at the tiger's mouth, but the tiger did not even blink. The young man kept shooting one shot after another at the tiger, but each time the grandfather tiger would clench his teeth and grab at his lips and let the bullets bounce off his fangs harmlessly. Undaunted, the young man kept shooting at the tiger, but in the end he ran out of bullets and was swallowed in one gulp, gun and all, by the great grandfather tiger. The tiger's throat was one black tunnel. Once the hunter had passed through this tunnel, he came to a vast room as large as a fairground. This was the giant tiger's stomach. The hunter was surprised to see scattered here and there the bones of people the tiger had eaten. He wondered whether he might not be able to find the bones of his father and started searching here and there. Just as he thought, he found his father's bones beside a hunting rifle on which his father's name was engraved. The son carefully got his bones together and lovingly placed them in the bag at his belt. And then the young man continued his search. He came upon an unconscious girl who lay huddled in a heap. The young hunter took the girl in his arms and nursed her back to consciousness. She looked into his face and thanked him with gratitude. She then revealed that she was the daughter of the king's minister, who was famous in the capital. The young girl told him how the old grandfather tiger had stolen her away just the night before while she was washing her hair on the veranda of her home. The two talked over their plight and decided to join forces in finding a way out of the tiger's stomach. The young hunter took a knife from his belt and cut a small hole near the tiger's tail. Through it, they could see outside. They decided that the girl should stay beside the hole and tell the young man whether the tiger was walking through a field or up some craggy cliff or along the seashore. The hunter's son then started cutting through the walls of the tiger's stomach. Because his stomach wall was so thick, he did not make much progress with his small knife. He cut with all his might and main and slowly started grinding the cut that he had started. The tiger at first bore his stomach pains, but as the pains increased, he could no longer keep still. He went to his doctor's son, an old girl, and said, oh, my my stomach grieves me terribly. Haven't you any good medicine? The boy answered, oh, there's nothing to worry about. Just eat a lot of fruit and you'll soon be well. The tiger then started eating apples and pears right and left, because his stomach became like one great fruit market. After all, being the huge animal that he was, the grandfather tiger was not content to eat only 100 or 200 apples or pears. He simply went into orchards and uprooted whole trees. The young girl and the man joyfully plucked the fruit from the trees swallowed whole by the tiger and filled their own stomachs. Now that they had eaten, they felt much stronger and took courage. With redoubled zeal, the young man fell to his work of cutting away the tiger's stomach. No matter how much fruit he ate, the tiger continued to feel greater and greater pain in his stomach. He went again to see the bear. I don't feel well at all. The pains in my stomach seem to be even worse than before. The bear then said, oh, go to the mineral spring and drink the water there. It's good for stomach ache. The giant grandfather tiger went to the spring and gulped down great volumes of water. The young man and the girl in the tiger's stomach drank the clear, sweet water and got quite refreshed. The young hunter again redoubled his efforts and kept slashing furiously away at the tiger's stomach. Seeing the tiger could no longer stand the pain in his stomach, he ran around like a crazed animal. He jumped from high cliffs and ran blindly through forests, knocking himself against rocks and trees. But no matter how he writhed and twisted, he could not get rid of the pain. Finally, even the grandfather tiger came to the end of his strength and stopped moving. The young girl picked out from a hole and found that they were by good fortune in the middle of a large field. She ran to the young man and helped him rip open the last remaining bit of flesh separating them from freedom, and then they stepped outside, safe and sound. The young man skinned the tiger, for he wanted to take home the beautiful white tiger skin as a present, and then taking the young girl by the hand, he returned to his home where his mother was waiting for him. His mother cried with tears of joy to see her son come back safely. After burying the bones of his father in the family graveyard, the young hunter took the young girl back to her home in the capital city. Words cannot describe the joy the king's minister felt when he saw his daughter returned home safe and sound. In gratitude, the king's minister adopted the young hunter into his family to become his daughter's husband and to be heir to his name and fortune. The young man returned to fetch his mother and the old woman of the mountain inn. And the whole family lived together happily ever after in the mansion of the king's minister. You've been listening to a story from the Story Bag, a collection of Korean folk tales by Kim Soo-in, published by Charles E. Tuttle Company. Northern Storyteller is a production of KACFM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. The executive producer is Carla Tanara, and I'm Ellen Hitcher.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Good morning. I'm Tom Hassler, and today I'll be reading from the book Best Loved Folk Tales of the World by Joanna Cole. It could always be worse. The poor Jew had come to the end of his rope, so he went to his rabbi for advice.
"Holy rabbi," he cried, "things are in a bad way with me and are getting worse all the time. We are poor, so poor that my wife, my 6 children, my in-laws and I, well, we have to live in a one-room hut. We get in each other's way all the time, and our nerves are frayed, and well, because we have plenty of trouble, we quarrel. Oh, believe me, my home is a hell, and I'd sooner die than continue living this way."
Well, the rabbi pondered the matter gravely. "My son," he said, "promise to do as I tell you, and your condition will improve."
"Oh, I promise, rabbi," answered the troubled man. "I will do anything you say."
"Tell me then, what animals do you own?"
"Well, I have a cow, a goat, and some chickens."
"Oh, very well. Go home now, and take all these animals into your house to live with you." The poor man was dumbfounded. But he promised the rabbi, he went home and brought all the animals into his house. The following day, the poor man returned to the rabbi and cried,
"Rabbi! What misfortune have you brought upon me? I did as you told me and brought the animals into the house, and now what have I got? Things are worse than ever. My life is a perfect hell. The house is turned into a barn. Oh, save me, rabbi. Help me."
"My son," replied the rabbi serenely, "go home and take the chickens out of your house. God will help you." So the poor man went home and took the chickens out of his house. But it was not long before his doom came running to the rabbi.
"Holy rabbi," he wailed, "help me, save me. The goat is smashing everything in the house. He's turning my life into a nightmare."
"Go home," said the rabbi gently, "and take the goat out of the house. Trust me, God will help you." The poor man returned to his house and removed the goat. But it wasn't long before he again came running to the rabbi, lamenting loudly,
"Oh, what a misfortune you brought upon my head, rabbi! The cow has turned my house into a stable. How can you expect a human being to live side by side with an animal?"
"You are right. 100 times right," agreed the rabbi. "Go straight home and take the cow out of your house." And the poor unfortunate hastened home and took the cow out of his house. And not a day had passed before he came running again to the rabbi.
"Rabbi," cried the poor man, his face beaming, "you've made my life sweet again for me. With all the animals out, why, the house is so quiet, so roomy, and so clean. What a pleasure!"
Chelm Justice. A great calamity befell Chelm one day. You see, the town cobbler murdered one of his customers. So he was brought before the judge, who sentenced him to die by hanging. When the verdict was read, a townsman arose and cried out,
"If your honor pleases, you've sentenced to death the town cobbler. He's the only one we've got. If you hang him, who will mend our shoes?" "Who, who, who?" cried the people of Chelm with one voice.
The judge nodded in agreement, and he reconsidered his verdict. "Good people of Chelm," he said, "what you say is true. Since we have only one cobbler, it would be a great wrong against the community to let him die. As there are 2 roofers in the town, let one of them be hanged instead." Saint or horse? A young man once came to a great rabbi and asked him to make him a rabbi. It was winter time then. The rabbi stood at the window looking out upon the yard while the rabbinical candidate was droning into his ears a glowing account of all of his piety and his learning. The young man said,
"You see, Rabbi, I always go dressed in spotless white like the sages of old. I never drink any alcoholic beverages, only water ever passes my lips, and also I perform austerities. I have sharp-edged nails inside my feet to mortify me. Even in the coldest weather, I lie naked in the snow to torment my flesh. Also, Baby the Sheriff gives me my 40 lashes on my bare back to complete my perpetual penance."
And as the young man spoke, a white horse was led into the yard and to the water trough. It drank. And then it rolled in the snow, as horses sometimes do.
"Just look," cried the rabbi. "That animal, too, is dressed in white. It also drinks nothing but water, has nails in its shoes, and rolls naked in the snow. Also, rest assured, it gets its daily ration of 40 lashes on the rump from its master. Now I ask you, is he a saint, or is he a horse?"
You've been listening to three Yiddish tales from the book Best Loved Folk Tales of the World, selected by Joanna Cole and published by Anchor Press Doubleday. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUACFM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. The engineer is Robert Gilfillian. The executive producer is Carla Tonella. And I'm Tom Hassler. And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Tom Hassler. Today I'll be reading from the book The Maid of the North by Ethel Johnston Phelps.
Gawain and the Lady Ragnall, an English tale. Long ago in the days of King Arthur, the finest knight in all Britain was the king's nephew, Gawain. He was by reputation the bravest in battle, the wisest, the most courteous, the most compassionate, and the most loyal to his king. One day in late summer, Gawain was with Arthur, the knights of the court at Carlisle in the north. The king returned from the day's hunting, looking so pale and shaken that Gawain followed him at once to his chamber. "What has happened, my lord?" asked Gawain with concern. Arthur sat down heavily.
"I had a very strange encounter in the Inglewood Forest. I hardly know what to make of it."
And he related to Gawain what had occurred.
"Today I hunted a great white stag," said Arthur. "The stag at last escaped me, and I was alone some distance from my men. Suddenly, a tall, powerful man appeared before me with sword upraised."
"And you were unarmed?"
"Yes. I had only my bow and a dagger in my belt. He threatened to kill me," Arthur went on. "And he swung his sword as though he meant to cut me down on the spot. Then he laughed horribly, and he said that he would give me one chance to save my life."
"Who was this man?" said Gawain.
"Why should he want to kill you?" "He said his name was Sir Gromer, and he sought revenge for the loss of his lord in land."
"The chieftain from the north," exclaimed Gawain. "But what is this one chance he spoke of?"
"Well, I gave him my word
that I would meet him 1 year from today, unarmed, at the same spot, with the answer to a question. Gawain started to laugh, but stopped at once when he saw Arthur's face. A question. It's a riddle. And 1 year to find the answer. That should not be too hard. If I can bring him the true answer to the question, what is it that women most desire above all else? My life will be spared. Arthur scowled. He is sure that I will fail. It must be a foolish riddle that no one can answer.
My lord, we have 1 year to search the kingdom for answers, said Gawain confidently. I will help you. Surely one of the answers will be the right one.
No doubt you are right, Gawain. Someone will know the answer. Arthur looked more cheerful. The man is mad, but a chieftain will keep his word.
Well, for the next 12 months, Arthur and Gawain asked the question, what is it that women most desire above all else, from one corner of the kingdom to the other? Then at last the appointed day drew near. Although they had many answers, Arthur was worried.
With so many answers to choose from, how do we know which is the right one? He asked in despair. Not one of them has the ring of truth.
Well, a few days before he was to meet Sir Gromer, Arthur rode out alone through the golden grass and purple heather. The track led upward toward a grove of great oaks. Arthur, deep in thought, did not look up until he reached the edge of the oak wood. When he raised his head, he pulled up suddenly in astonishment. Before him was a grotesque woman. She was almost as wide as she was high. Her skin was mottled green, and spikes of weed-like hair covered her head. Her face seemed more animal than human. The woman's eyes met Arthur's fearlessly.
You are Arthur the King, she said in a harsh, croaking voice. In 2 days' time, you must meet Sir Gromer with the answer to a question.
Arthur turned cold with fear. He stammered.
Yes, that is true. Who are you? How did you know of this?
I am the Lady Ragnall. Sir Gromer is my stepbrother. You haven't found the true answer, have you?
Oh, I have many answers, Arthur replied curtly. I do not see how my business can serve you.
He gathered up the reins, eager to be gone.
You do not have the right answer.
Her certainty filled him with a sense of doom. The harsh voice went on.
But I know the answer to Sir Gromer's question.
Arthur turned back in hope and disbelief.
You do?
Tell me the true answer to this question, and I will give you a large bag of gold.
I have no use for gold, she said coldly.
Nonsense, my good woman. With gold you can buy anything you want.
She hesitated a moment. For the huge, grotesque face with the cool, steady eyes unnerved him. He went on hurriedly.
What is it that you do want, then? Jewelry? Land? Whatever you want, I will pay you. That is, if you truly have the right answer.
I know the answer. I promise you that. What I demand in return is that the knight Gawain become my husband.
There was a moment of shocked silence. Then Arthur cried,
Impossible! You ask the impossible, woman!
She shrugged and turned to leave.
No, wait a minute, wait!
Rage and panic overwhelmed him. He tried to speak reasonably.
I offer you gold, land, jewels. I cannot give you my nephew. He is his own man. He is not mine to give.
I did not ask you to give me the knight, Gawain, she rebuked him. If Gawain agrees himself to marry me, I will give you the answer. Those are my terms.
Impossible, he sputtered. I could not believe such a proposal.
If you should change your mind, I will be here tomorrow,
she said, and disappeared into the oak woods. Taken from the weird encounter, Arthur rode homeward at a slow pace.
Save my own life at Gawain's expense? Never, he thought. Loathsome woman! I could not even speak of it to Gawain.
But the afternoon air was soft and sweet with birdsong, and the fateful meeting with Sir Gromer weighed on him heavily. He was torn by the terrible choice facing him. Gawain rode out from the castle to meet the king, and seeing Arthur's pale, strained face, he exclaimed,
"My lord, are you ill? What has happened?"
"Nothing, nothing at all."
But he could not keep silent long.
"The colossal impudence of the woman! A monster, that's what she is! That creature dying to give me chance!"
"Calm yourself, uncle,"
Gawain said patiently.
"What woman? Turn for what?"
Arthur sighed.
"She knows the answer to the question. I didn't intend to tell you."
"Why not? Surely that's good news. What is the answer?"
"She will not tell me until he turns on me," said the king. "But I assure you, I refuse to consider her proposal."
Gawain smiled.
"You talk in riddles yourself, uncle. Who is this woman who claims to know the answer? What is her proposal?"
Seeing Gawain's smiling, expectant face, Arthur at first could not speak. Then, with his eyes averted, the king told Gawain the whole story, leaving out no detail.
"Your Lady Ragnall is Sir Gromer's stepsister. Yes, I think she would know the right answer. How fortunate that I will be able to save your life."
"No, I will not let you sacrifice yourself," Arthur cried.
"It is my choice and my decision," Gawain answered. "I will return with you tomorrow and agree to the marriage, on condition that the answer she supplies is the right one to save your life."
Early the following day, Gawain rode out with Arthur. But not even meeting the loathsome lady face to face could shake his resolve. Her proposal was accepted. Gawain bowed courteously.
"If on the morrow your answer saves the king's life, we will be wed."
On the fateful morning, Gawain watched the king stow a parchment in his saddlebag.
"I'll try all these answers first," said Arthur.
They rode together for the first part of the journey. Then Arthur, unarmed as agreed, rode on alone to Inglewood to meet Sir Gromer. The tall, powerful chieftain was waiting, his broad sword glinting in the sun.
Arthur read off one answer, then another and another. Sir Gromer shook his head in dissatisfaction.
"No, is not the right answer,"
he said, raising his sword.
"You failed, and now wait, Arthur cried. I have one more answer. What a woman desires above all else is the power of sovereignty, the right to exercise her own will."
With a loud oath, the man dropped his sword. "You did not find that answer by yourself," he shouted. "My cursed stepsister Ragnall gave it to you. Bold, interfering hussy, I'll run her through with my sword. I'll lop at her head."
And turning, he plunged into the forest, a string of horrible curses echoing behind him. Arthur rode back to where Gawain waited with the monstrous Ragnar. They returned to the castle in silence. Only the grotesque Lady Ragnar seemed in good spirits. The news spread quickly throughout the castle. Gawain, the finest knight in land, was to marry this monstrous creature. Some tittered and laughed at the spectacle. Others said the Lady Ragnall must possess very great lands and estates. But mostly, there was stunned silence. Arthur took his nephew aside nervously.
"Must you go through with this at once? A postponement, perhaps?"
Gawain looked at him steadily. "I gave my promise, my lord."
The Lady Ragnall's answer saved your life. Would you have me?
Your loyalty makes me ashamed. Of course you cannot break your word.
And Arthur turned away. The marriage took place in the abbey, and afterward, with Gawain and the Lady Ragnall sitting at the high dais table beside the king and queen, the strange wedding feast began.
"It was the space of two women on the chair," muttered the knight guard. "Poor Gawain!
I would not marry such a creature for all the land in Christendom," answered his companion. Well, an uneasy silence settled on the hall, and only the monstrous Lady Ragnall displayed good spirits and good appetite. Throughout the long day and evening, Gawain remained pleasant and courteous. In no way did his manner toward his strange bride show other than kind attention. The wedding feast drew to a close. Gawain and his bride were conducted to their chamber, and were at last alone. The Lady Ragnall gazed at her husband thoughtfully.
"You kept your promise well and faithfully," she observed.
Gawain inclined his head. "I could not do less, my lady."
"You found neither revolt nor pity," she said. And after a pause, she went on. "Come, now we are wedded. I am waiting to be kissed."
Gawain went to her at once and kissed her. When he stepped back, there stood before him a slender young woman with gray eyes and a serene, smiling face.
He stopped tingling shock. "What manner of sorcery is this?" he cried hoarsely.
"Do you prefer me in this form?" she smiled and turned slowly in a full circle. But Gawain backed away wary.
Yes, of course, but I don't understand.
For the sudden evidence of sorcery, with its unknown powers, made him confused and uneasy. "My stepbrother Sir Gromer had always hated me," said the Lady Ragnall. "Unfortunately, through his mother, he has a knowledge of sorcery, and so he changed me into a monstrous creature. He said I must live in that shape until I could persuade the greatest knight in Britain to willingly choose me for his bride. He said it would be an impossible condition to meet."
"Why did he hate you so cruelly?"
Her lips curled in amusement.
"He thought me bold and unwomanly, because I defied him. I refused his commands, both for my property and my person."
Gawain said with admiration,
"You won the impossible condition," he said, "and now his evil spell is broken."
"Only in part," the clear gray eyes held his. "You have a choice, my dear Gawain, which way I will be. Would you have me in this my own shape at night, and my former ugly shape by day? Or would you have me grotesque at night in our chamber, and my own shape in the castle by day? Think carefully before you choose." Gawain was silent only a moment. He knelt before her and touched her hand.
"It is a choice I cannot make, my dear Ragnall. It concerns you. Whatever you choose to be, fair by day or fair by night, I will willingly abide by it."
Ragnall released a long, deep breath. The radiance of her face overwhelmed him.
"You have answered well, dearest Gawain, for your answer has broken Gromer's evil spell completely. The last condition he set has been met, for he said that if after marriage to the greatest knight in Britain, my husband freely gave me the power of choice, the power to exercise my own free will, the wicked enchantment would be broken forever."
Thus, in wonder and in joy, began the marriage of Gawain and the Lady Ragnall.
You've been listening to a story, Gawain and Lady Ragnall, from the book The Maid of the North, written by Ethel Johnson Phelps, published by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. and executive producer Carla Canella. I'm Tom Hassel. And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Tom Hassler. Today I'll be reading from the book The Unbroken Web, Stories and Fables by Richard Adams. The Robin. Sermons are too long when you're 7, aren't they? As a matter of fact, they're sometimes too long when you're 37. And I dare say, if Grandpa were here, he might say, when you're 77. Don't worry. You've done me a good turn. Anyway, there's no virtue in trying to listen to a lot of stuff you can't be expected to understand. Padre Wood's coming to tea on Tuesday, and he'll tell you the same thing himself, I dare say. Let's sit down in the sun, shall we, on this nice flat tombstone. Wait for them to come out. I don't suppose it'll be very long. Whose tombstone is it, I wonder? Let's have a look. Beneath this stone are deposited the mortal remains of Thomas Christina Francis, beloved wife of Horatio James Cremorne, physician of St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, and of this parish, who departed this life in her 70th year on 23rd April in the year of our Lord, 1795. Cherished mother, an amiable spouse, and a congenial friend. She deserved and obtained the admiration and esteem of the whole society. There shall be no more death, for the former things are passed away. Well, I think poor old Dr. Cremorne must have taken a lot of trouble over that, don't you? I suppose he wrote it himself. It may sound a bit old-fashioned now, but I'm sure his feelings were just as real as anyone's today. Hey, look, there's a robin over there on that flowering campus. I've got a dog biscuit here in my pocket just a moment. I generally carry one on Sunday for old Pinker. Mrs. Sweet was Pinker, you know. But I know it's good Friday, same thing, only different, as they say. Well, let's break it up a bit. See if he comes and takes the crumbs. So let's gather them on this other tombstone over here, and see what happens. Yes, there you are. He's on it. Back of the night. Is he tame? There's usually a resident robin in the churchyard, you know, especially one that isn't full. They're quiet, undisturbed places, you see, with flowers and bushes that attract insects. And of course, whenever the sexton has any digging to do, the robin can lend a hand with the worms and the beetles. That's it. Oh, very well, be the sexton that made this fellow so tame. Robins are lucky, you know. No one in his senses harms a robin. There's an old legend about him, my nurse, Constance Cripps, her name was. She told me the story a long time ago. She didn't say she believed it, but when I asked her, she wouldn't say that she didn't either. He said that long ago, on that first Good Friday, when Jesus was condemned by Pontius Pilate, there was a robin living near the gate of Jerusalem. He used to peck about at the side of the road and pick up crumbs from the camel drivers and market people who were always coming and going. Well, he saw the crowd coming out of the gate that morning, and the soldiers in the middle of it all. And he saw this poor fellow Jesus and the other two driving their crosses up the road. Dreadful sight. Of course, he didn't know what it was all about.
But he considered everyone as being unkind to this fellow Jesus and shouting and throwing things. He felt sorry for him because he thought he looked the kind sort of a man, and because he was all alone and helpless among those soldiers. And the robin was frightened of the noise and the crowd, but all the same, he couldn't help wondering what was going to happen. And so he flew along in the hedges and bushes beside the road and kept up with the soldiers. And when they got to Calvary, he stayed a little way off, but he was near enough to see what happened. After a time, he felt he couldn't bear to stay there and not try to help Jesus. So although he was still frightened, he flew up to the cross and began trying to pull out the nails. But of course he couldn't do that. It only hurt his beak. But after trying as hard as he could, he flew up to Jesus' head and began pulling out the thorns. Well, at that point, one of the soldiers picked up a stone to throw at the robin, but the centurion stopped him, told him just not to do it, and said that no one was to hurt the robin or drive him away. We know that this centurion felt sorry for Jesus, and that during that day he became convinced that he was indeed the Son of God, because three of the four Gospels all tell us that. The Gospels don't give us his name any more than they give us the names of the wise men. But in all the old legends and stories, his name is Longinus. Before he died, Jesus blessed the robin and promised that forever after, whenever they saw him, people would remember what he had done. He was all covered with Jesus' blood, which had dried on his dress feathers, and from that day to this, his dress has remained the color of dried blood. He was still there at the end of that terrible afternoon when Longinus and the soldiers took Jesus' body down and gave it to Joseph of Arimathea to lay in the sepulchre. And as Longinus had fed him and treated him kindly, the robin followed him back to the city and took to living in his garden. For he soon got so tame that he often used to come in through the window to pick up crumbs and bits of food. Now the legend says, part of the King Arthur story actually, and one day I'll read it to you in Mallory, that Longinus and Joseph of Arimathea became great friends and were among the first Christians and followers of the disciples. But after a time, they grew afraid of what Pontius Pilate and King Herod might do to them, so they decided to leave the country. In the Middle Ages, people used to believe that they sailed together to England, and that with them they brought these things: a piece of the cross, the spear with which Longinus had pierced Jesus' side after he died, and the Holy Grail. The cup. Yes, the cup which Jesus had blessed at the Last Supper. The legend says that the piece of the cross was planted at Glastonbury in Somerset, and from it sprung up the holy Glastonbury thorn, which was believed to bloom at midnight on Christmas Eve. The Grail was mysteriously received into heaven, but was later revealed to three of King Arthur's knights. They were Sir Galahad, Sir Bors, and Sir Percival. And what became of the spear, I don't remember to have heard. If the robin came to England too, Longinus had become so fond of him and his red breast that he made him a little cage and he sailed with them on the ship. And when they reached England, they let him go. And ever since then, he's lived near people's houses and brought them good luck. And often he's so tame that he'll come in through the kitchen window, and sometimes even feed out of your hand, just like Longinus is robin. If you're digging in the garden, he'll come and peck about in the newly dug ground. And he never leaves England, even in the hardest winter weather. Why, the unluckiest thing you can do is to harm a robin, or let your cat hurt one. When the early settlers went to America, they missed the robin very much. They aren't any over there, you see, and so they gave the name robin to another bigger bird, which happens to have a chestnut-colored breast, although it's not much like the English robin. It's actually sort of a thrush, the Turdus migratorius, and its habits are quite different from our robins.
Of course, we oughtn't to forget these legends make such as the really important stories in the Gospels about Jesus and the disciples. But all the same, they are beautiful and worth remembering, because they show that ordinary, faithful people in the old days used to feel very deeply about Jesus and connect things in their own lives and surroundings with him. Ah, here they all come back. Look, like sparks up the backs of a chimney, as my father used to say. My goodness, look. Look at Mr. Sleepy's new hat. Do you mind if we just wait a minute or two? I want to have a word with Padre Wood about the new net for the cricket field. You've been listening to a story, The Robin, from the book The Unbroken Web, Stories and Fables by Richard Adams, published by Crown Publishers. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. The engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Canella. And I'm Tom Hassler. The people,